Hi, this is Mike McNamara, and you're listening to All Marine Radio on your home for it, the one and only All Warrior Radio Network. Special edition of All Marine Radio, continuing the series that we started doing on discipline called On Discipline of All Things. And we've had General Van Riper, we've had General Halick on, and now joining me is a name that's familiar to everybody if you know anything about the Marine Corps, and that is former Secretary of Defense, former Commanding General Central Command, and I know him best as a Commanding General as of the 1st Marine Division, where I work for him, and that is Jim Mattis. Sir, first of all, welcome to All Marine Radio, and thanks for doing this.
Well, happy to be here, Mac. Always my first love is the U.S. Marines.
I think what's important about these interviews and what I love about them, and what the Marines that write me about love them, is they get to hear the why behind, you know, behind people's thoughts, and so we're gonna walk down the same path that we did with General Van Riper and General Halick. So and that starts with you're born and raised where?
Well, it's a pleasure to do this, Max. I think that the Marines understand the why behind something, and they're a lot more effective at carrying it out. But I was formed by my experience being raised by mostly World War II veterans in my neighborhood out in Eastern Washington. Born in Pullman, raised in Richland, went to school at Central Washington State College then, university now, in Ellensburg. And a lot of time outdoors, a lot of time playing sports, a lot of time hunting, fishing, swimming, hiking, that sort of thing in the mountains around here. But as I came out of high school, my brother was in the Marines. He got out of the Marines as a sergeant, but he was serving in Vietnam. And so that kind of attracted me to the Marines, knowing that in those days, most of us would end up getting drafted at some point. And I thought if I was going to go, I'd go with the varsity.
Interesting. Your brother, what was his MOS?
He was a supply guy in an artillery unit in a headquarters battery of an artillery battalion.
Wow. I wonder, because, you know, Eastern Washington isn't exactly a hotbed of recruiting for the Marine Corps. I mean, there's not a lot of Marines up there, and so, but everybody's got a connection, and so not hard to follow in the footsteps of your brother. You enlist now, my understanding, reading your biography, is you enlist in the Marine Corps Reserve out of high school?
Well, I was in college, and I wasn't doing all that well. And I got a phone call saying that I might want to be looking for a different kind of draft deferment than my college deferment because of what I was doing. So I went down to the Marine recruiter, and he talked initially about the reserves. I said, fine. And when I went home from college for the summer, I got a telegram saying that I had a ticket waiting for me in July to go to Washington, D.C. So I thought they must have recognized talent early. But it turned out when I got there, I was for the officer candidate school where the corporals and sergeants explained early on that they had not seen any talent in me, and I was going to have to buckle down and prove it.
So you graduated from college off to officer candidate school. How do you decide on on your MOS? What attracted you to being a grunt?
Well, growing up, I spent a lot of time hiking in the mountains, in the desert, hunting and fishing. I didn't have any intention at that time of staying in the Marine Corps a long time, so I thought I'd just enjoy myself, get paid to go camping, and that sort of thing. I didn't have the most sophisticated understanding of the infantry, but it seemed like the right place to go. I intended to come back to my hometown and teach physics or history or something like that and coach sports. So I had no intention of staying in the Marine Corps for over 40 years.
The I read that both your parents are readers, and that your mom actually worked for intelligence director in the Second World War, and your father was in the nuclear energy business. Is that accurate? Not knowing, sir.
Yeah, my dad was a merchant marine chief engineer on a ship, and for about 15 years in the merchant marine. Met my mom there when she went to South Africa to work at the embassy. Interesting sideline about the Marine Corps. When she got there, the person that was in an independent country was part of the British Commonwealth, so the consular general there was the former commandant of the Marine Corps, General Holcomb.
Wow.
Was sent there. And so she actually knew something about Marines when my brother joined the Marines. But yeah, they're part of the greatest generation. My dad floated on merchant ships against the U-boat threat, that sort of thing. And my mom was actually in the first tranche of people who went to work initially in the Pentagon before she was ordered to South Africa to the Defense Attaché Office.
I know I learned to be a reader from my mom. I also read that both your parents were readers, and you picked that you grew up in a house that didn't have a television, and both your parents were readers. Is that accurate?
Yeah, they instilled that love of reading in me, and things I spent a lot of time outdoors as well. It's kind of balanced in that regard. But not shaped much like television, even though television was coming of age, and we spent a lot of time indoors on that sort of thing.
So on the subject of discipline, as you enter the Marine Corps, during some pretty tough years. Vietnam's winding down, and it's a pretty interesting time in the Marine Corps. You know, the country's changing, the military's changing. You had Secretary of Defense McNamara, his McNamara 100,000 that was still some of them still in the service. What between the ranks of second lieutenant, as you joined the operating forces and went into all of that, what was that like?
Well, it was a lot different. The Marine Corps got better over the years. They were good Marines, by and large, although we had some who couldn't have been ever brought into the Marine Corps. But we lost an awful lot of our NCOs, either as casualties or they just got fed up with the way the country treated them when they came back. So my first platoon sergeant was Corporal Wayne Johnson, an immigrant from the British West Indies, who promptly was given the nickname John Wayne, of course. But he was a wonderful young man, taught me a lot as a second lieutenant. My next platoon sergeant was Corporal Manuel Rivera, an immigrant from Mexico. And again, strong NCO, could make, just like Corporal Johnson, he'd get 40 Marines falling out ready to go to the field. Without 1 ounce of guidance from me, squared away, they had the right gear, they're ready. So my next platoon sergeant, finally I got a staff sergeant that gave me bragging rights at the officer's club, Staff Sergeant Remy LeBrun from Quebec, Canada. So, these were the young NCOs, Staff Sergeant, even Staff Sergeant LeBrun, looking back on it, pretty young, only 28, who, put their thumbprint on me. Infantry officers are largely shaped by the NCOs, of course, and I was bred from my first days under then OCS Staff Sergeant Collier and Gunnery Sergeant Dudley. I still remember them very clearly. These were the people who put their thumbprint on us, the Vietnam veterans who knew that we would be tested someday, and they broke no nonsense. They were hardcore guys, but they were hard on the issues, not hard on their people. They were actually, in their own way, some of the best coaches I've ever seen in any sport or field. So I went up to lieutenant, first lieutenant, captain. I was on recruiting duty, and I saw the Marine Corps switching from the draft years. We went all volunteer. Hard to get good quality people the way the military was looked at. And so we went through tough years, and eventually the Marine Corps became the most successful of the recruiting services, bringing in top quality people that we see today. But I saw that transition in those days, and of course then General Gray coming in and turned the Marine Corps into an operational and tactical virtuoso based on the discipline of maneuver warfare, where you delegate more authority to young people to make decisions, juniors, and seniors give broad guidance and then support them. But it takes a more disciplined force to operate like that, or you'll just have helper shelter on the battlefield. So I saw the Marine Corps from basically second lieutenant through major go through these metamorphoses, all volunteer, much more tactically capable through the 29 Psalms that we overall put through, and eventually saw it all come together there as a lieutenant colonel commanding the battalion in Desert Shield and Desert Storm.
Hey, sir, I want to ask about that period, and that, you know, General Barrows, I mean, you talk about guys that are in the pantheon of heroes for Marines, but his decision as a commandant and the expeditious discharge and all that he put in, I mean, you, obviously your lens has changed as, you know, as you went through the Marine Corps and then ultimately at the Secretary of Defense position. How, when you look at that now, a decision like that, I mean, that was not a small that decision was not a small decision, and he took a fair amount of grief for it, proposing it, and didn't get a whole lot of support from the general officers of the Marine Corps relative to it. When you think about that decision now, you were part of the Marine Corps then. Talk to us about what that was like when you all were going through that.
Yeah, and we experienced it, and what it did was immediately make sure that if someone didn't meet Marine Corps standards, they'd be gone. And so they cleaned up the ranks, but they also changed the way we were recruiting. Xerox Corporation had purchased basically a sales scene that changed the whole way the Marine Corps looked at what kind of people we wanted to attract. And it raised the standards, but also everybody in my chain of command was 100% on board. This is from captain and lieutenant colonel, every general. It was just a breath of fresh air to get rid of the ones that didn't belong there and change the recruiting so we didn't continue to bring in guys that sometimes judges wanted off the street or something like that. So it was very much embraced, coupled with General Gray's focus on war fighting. It restored the Marine Corps to its legendary purpose, and that is to be able to fight and fight well.
The your career, second lieutenant through major, is pretty typical infantry officer career. How would you describe yourself and as a disciplinarian in that? Because, you know, I joined the Marine Corps in 1983, and the Marine Corps was, I don't think it had changed very much. I mean, you polished boots, ironed utilities, you know, you were on time. The staff NCOs, you know, they kind of ruled the roost. And the violence in the Marine Corps had largely disappeared. But they still, I mean, they had all the tools available to them. They could play fuck with you, right? You know, a lot of guys dig in fighting positions, mortar positions out back, and they could assign you to, we still worked in the chow halls, and they had a tremendous amount of authority, then, and you know, field day was inspected. You know, there was a meter to the way we lived that I think hadn't changed in a long time. As you matured as a young officer, can you describe yourself as a disciplinarian? What you believed in, what you put emphasis on in your units, whether it be your platoon or your recruiting command?
Well, going back to your opening point there about the why behind discipline, I saw myself basically as a coach. I finally learned by first lieutenant, as much as my rambunctious young troops once in a while would get me chewed out by my company commander for their antics on Liberty, they didn't stay awake at night thinking how can they screw up Lieutenant Mattis's day the next day. And if you coach your troops, if you really understand them, if you get into their 95%, not the top 5%, if you really know your troops, you know their hopes, you know their goals, their education goals, if you know what they want to do socially, if they're thinking about getting married, if you know what they want to do as far as a career, stay in the Marine Corps, get out, do something else. I just saw most of the staff in Pierre's lists were strong guys, and they knew how to deal with the troops in a direct way, a way that officers do not. But by and large, they were admired, the ones I was with. I'd say easily the overwhelming majority were admired by the troops. And I thought the Marine Corps by the early 80s was now on the right track. It had a long way to go in terms of getting the right equipment, the light armored vehicles, the better infantry gear. But all those decisions had been made, and now it's a matter of budget, training, and changing the education to embrace maneuver warfare. By certainly after those first 10 years of active duty in the early 80s, I had seen the Marine Corps just change enormously in a positive way, and it was on the right track.
All right, you take over 1st Battalion, 7th Marines, and as part of Task Force Ripper during the Gulf War, you guys essentially lead the 1st Division into Kuwait, into Kuwait City. How did going, and this is your first experience in combat, how did that experience of preparing, of executing, and coming home, how did that impact your thoughts on discipline? You know, had the things that you learned up to that point, did you believe that they prepared you for everything that wasn't going to happen in front of you organizationally, and did it see you through to Kuwait City? Did it see you through coming back? And then I want to talk about the attitude of Marines, this whole, you know, garrison's chicken shit, and the only thing that really counts is combat when you guys came home, because this is a cycle that the Marine Corps and the Army and everybody goes through. Talk to us about how that first experience, did it change you? What did you take away from it as a leader, and your thoughts on discipline relative to it?
Yeah, my battalion was up at, we were out in 29th Assault Station there, of course, so we had a lot of live fire training. We could always have ammunition. There was never a limit on that because units didn't use their full allotment for the CACs, the tests that we do out there in the desert. We just built clean their ammo and signed for it. So we were pretty good with small arms, pretty handy with all the weapon systems in the battalion. We got over the desert, during Desert Shield. We had just come out of Mountain Warfare Training Center, and we were in very good physical shape. We were training 6 days a week out in the desert, sleeping on the ground the whole time, seldom had showers, that sort of thing. Heat was upwards of 105 degrees when we first got there. Many of the men lost weight. We all lost weight. And the discipline standards were such that at night you could not see, anything when the time was beefed up to over 1,250 troops, sailors, Marines, and ladies, who were all embedded in the unit. But at night you couldn't find that unit right in front of you on the desert floor, unless you had MVGs. There was not a light shown. Every vehicle was covered with a tanning net. As you heard, the men went everywhere with weapons and their combat gear. It was a very, very effectively run unit, not thanks to me. I just asked the kind of junior officers and NCOs I had When we went into the fight, it had been anticipated. We had very heavy casualties, hundreds killed and wounded, breaking through the two obstacle belts, plane trenches and minefields. We got through the first one faster than any of the ones we had done in training 6 days a week that we practiced it from Met Company commanders to the Lance Corporals who ran the armored bulldozers to fill in the trenches. we rehearsed it until we could do it in the dark. And when we broke through, we lost some men wounded, but it was the first and last time I would bring everybody home alive from a fight. If the enemy had our weapons and they had and we had their weapons, the discipline of the battalion would have resulted in the same outcome. We might have lost more troops, but the fact is, it was the discipline and the confidence the Marines had in each other, when we were ordered into those minefields, that we opened those minefields faster under fire in combat than we did, in training. So it's a very, very disciplined unit. And coming home, it was a little bit like after World War II, I think. Because if you read Fehrenbach's book about the Marines in Korea, mm-hmm. he talked about how well disciplined they were. So that's the Marine Corps that came out of World War II, and there was no sense that garrison is chicken shit. The Marine Corps focused on war fighting, and if you read that book, you realize how the Marines got out of Chosin Reservoir more based on their discipline and the leadership of the NCOs and officers than anything else. Having come out of Desert Storm with so few casualties, having refuted those who said we were going to lose hundreds, it was a clear win for the discipline. And you can't say I'm going to be disciplined in the field but not in garrison. If you show me a unit with a lot of drug use, with DUIs, sexual harassment, I'll show you a unit that doesn't have good fire discipline, doesn't have good light discipline, and probably has disciplinary problems as a result. You either lead a disciplined life or you lead an undisciplined life. You don't turn it on and off. Human beings aren't built like that. And so I didn't say that when we came back from Desert Storm because it was so compelling that we brought everybody home alive in my time. Matter of fact, the NCOs gave me a little statue of a Marine, and they only had one thing on it: thanks for bringing us all home. So everybody knew how that had paid off, and I did not see degradation in discipline coming out of Desert Storm, which is good considering 10 years later. Lead Marines again into a fight that we hadn't anticipated in Afghanistan.
You know, sir, it's interesting in this whole discussion that General Furness kind of lit off out of the 2nd Division about discipline in the Marine Corps, that, you know, if you read Sledge's second book, I think it's called Combat Marine, and it picks up his story after they leave, the 5th Marines leave Okinawa and they go to China, and he winds up in Beijing, and they fall into, they don't go back to live in the same buildings, but they go live in where the same, you know, with the legation, where the foreign troops were quartered and whatnot, and they fall back into that routine of spit shining, of, you know, parades and uniforms and things like that. And he doesn't mention a whole lot about people talking about it was chicken shit. He mentions that, you know, the point system after World War II and who got to go home when, you know, was an issue with some people. But the discipline and the way they treated each other didn't seem to be. So it's kind of interesting, you know, that comes up, you know, now and where it comes up. And is that, do you think that's a cultural thing? This asking why now? Do you think, or maybe as a culture, we don't do discipline now very much. We don't do consequences so much. We don't do adversity so much. Do you think it's just the way our culture's gone? Is there, you have any thoughts on any reason for it?
I it's all about the coaching, and if you have NCOs or junior officers, and those are the ones who are, you know, whose social energy actually animates the troop, wins the respect. Your rank is given to you by the Commandant of the Marine Corps, Secretary of the Navy, but your troops will determine if you're a leader or not. And if you, I used to wonder sometimes, why was one unit in combat, one platoon in combat, worth a compass when they were in a fight? And it took a long time to figure it out. But I found that there was something beyond trust and respect in those units. There was trust and there was respect. And you find that in most well-run units. That's not a new from the Marine Corps. But there's also affection. And I'm not talking about popularity with all the favoritism that comes with desire for being popular. That's a bunch of crap. But true affection. Like, even when people are dropping around you, you know that people will hold. And I think that the kind of leader that sets the conditions in a unit for that affection to grow creates a unit that the enemy cannot stop. They can shoot it down. I remember at one point as a two-star in Anbar province, I had 29 sailors and Marines in my jump CP command post that went everywhere with me. Vehicle operators, gunners, communicators, aide de camp, intel, corporal, that sort of thing, corpsman. And in a period of 4 months, 17 of those 29 lads were killed or wounded around me. And I'd walk out each day, and even bandaged up, there they'd be, ready to go again the next day as we tried to hold the line there, break tough time there in 2004 in Anbar province, Fallujah, Ramadi, Al-Qaim, you know the names. And my lieutenant had been badly wounded, evacuated, so I had a gunnery sergeant for my aide as a two-star. And he was a communicator. He was harder than petrified woodpecker. But every time we went out, there was a rehearsal. I told the troops, you can bounce a check at the PX, and your first sergeant's going to kick your ass, and he's going to make you take a balance in your checkbook course from MCI. But I said, he'll handle that. But if you ever take a unit on patrol that you didn't rehearse ahead of time, actions on enemy contact are going to get court-martialed. That's what was important. And that gunny puts them through those pages each time. I remember once he's walking up to one of the wounded guys that we were pitching onto a stretcher. He's a young guy. He's very painfully wounded. He wouldn't badly, it's going to be okay, but he's going into shock, and you see it. And the guy comes walking up, and he says, man, you sure screwed up your health record this time. He was seen as a guy who was just harder than petrified woodpecker lips, and there was no slacking off on discipline, on which way weapons were pointed, on weapon cleanliness, on who fired and who ran forward and that sort of thing. He was by the book. But the book has been written in a lot of combat fights. And when you have people like that around, the troops loved it, to tell you the truth. They thought the world of him. And it was, as a result, that kind of discipline and that kind of understanding, knowing the toughest guy in the unit is your leader, is the gunny. And by the way, he's on your side, he's your coach. He's not anti you, he's trying to keep you alive in the toughest circumstance. And if you don't do that in garrison and peacetime, you don't just turn that on. You don't just develop that with someone who's grown up through the ranks and looking the other way when people don't meet standards.
You know, sir, you know, I working for you, I watch those guys every day, and they loved doing what they did, and it was dangerous work because the CG, he got around the battlefield, and there were obviously people looking for he and his PSD, and those Marines were fired up every day, and I mean General Mattis went almost every day. I mean he would, when he took breaks, he didn't take them for himself. He took them for so that other people would have a bit of a break. His guys would have a bit of a break, but they were. Those guys were hard-working, great Marines, and they all flew out with you when you left, and that was they were. But I mean, they were so proud, and the gunning. I mean, you're right. I mean, he rode them hard, and you know, you relate that affection. That affection. The the book, Fehrenbach's book, This Kind of War. If for those of you listening, if you've never read that book, write that book down. It is one of the great books about discipline that you'll ever read, right? When other people were not prepared, the thing that kept the Marine Corps prepared was discipline and the way they were able to get to the fight and fight, not at Pusan and then do Incheon and then up to the Chosin, but and the legacy that some of those guys, the story that they wrote is unbelievable, and it's that affection thing comes through in the book, the way they talk about each other. I wish I could remember off the top of my head. There's a quote by a chaplain, and he says, these Marines have a pious sense about them. Their loose sense of public property aside, they are convinced to the point of arrogance that they are the most ferocious fighters. And the truth is that they are. And there's these wonderful quotes about the fighting spirit, the discipline of them in that book. And so if you haven't read it, it's an amazing read. It's an amazing read. The affection thing is interesting, sir. I want to ask you, as you go up in rank, in theory, you're separated for the Marines from the Marines that you lead by more and more layers of commanders. Do you have to learn how to emphasize different things at different levels as you become a more senior commander? The way you do discipline, is it different? How do you imbue discipline, you know, 3 and 4 and 5 layers below you as you rise in rank? What are your thoughts on that? Or is it the same?
Well, you still have to be a role model. If you're going, you can't talk the talk. The troops will see through it right away if they're not living by the same standard you're espousing. So you're going to have to live it, number one. And that means especially those around you, your closest-knit officers, and, of course, your sergeant major, the people who are closest around you are also conveying that every day because they see what you tolerate and what you absolutely will not tolerate. And if the troops always knew what I would tolerate, and if a troop made a mistake and they were trying to carry out my intent, then I would stand by until the pallet came home. And I did it on several occasions, including once when a congressman had called the Marines cold-blooded murderers or something, and I dismissed the charges on them after reviewing the charges and what had gone on, what those Marines had been through. But at the same time, I expected high levels of discipline, high standards of discipline. And there were some things that I made very clear from higher levels that I would not tolerate. I used to call them a third rail, like on a subway, the third rail that carries 40,000 volts. If you do that one, and don't come to me and expect, I'll be dry-eyed, you know, if you violate this. For example, you do something to a prisoner once he's under your control, you fail to do a rehearsal or fail to put out guardian angels. I'm not looking for amateur performance in the Marine Corps. Staff Sergeant Collier in my first 6 weeks, the Marine Corps taught us, we will be satisfied if you give 100%, but we will be totally dissatisfied if all you commit is 99%. We're not looking for half-assed Marines, he put it in his blunt way. So as I went up higher, I spent more time doing two things. one, I spent a long time writing out my intent so that at least two or three levels below me, they knew exactly what I wanted. And then I spent a lot of time going out and talking to, for example, a division commander. I'd talk to the battalion size group, and I would talk to them repeatedly. And I'd stop and see them, and I would always de-emphasize my intent. Marines, 99% know that if they know what you want, they will deliver. They will literally put their lives on the line to accomplish a mission. If they don't know what you want, then that's your problem. Look in the mirror. You're the problem. You better get your sharpen up on your intent. So the 1% that you can always have anywhere, I remind people, even Jesus of Nazareth had 1 out of 12 sort of mud on him. Those guys were going to have to be dealt with by the NCOs and officers. And that's what makes the Marine Corps a disciplined outfit. You're held accountable for your actions. And it's the naval service is the varsity. You run your ship on the rocks, you get your unit in trouble, you fail to carry out your duty. The gunnery sergeants and first sergeants, the captains and lieutenant colonels are not there to help you through your midlife crisis. You're going to pay for it, and hopefully you'll get a second chance to prove yourself, reprove yourself, if you're a Marine. But amateur performance is anathema to the Marine Corps. We're not interested in a lack of discipline or a lack of physical fitness, a lack of tactical cunning, or someone who can't keep the faith when things go wrong. One of the toughest things I had to do was pull Marines out of Fallujah. After the first battle of Fallujah, when we were ordered to pull back and negotiate. And I didn't want to go in the first place in that manner. And then once in, I didn't want to stop. And the Marines checked the face coming up. They didn't suck their thumb. They didn't act like a victim or get cynical. I still remember one slow-talking saw gunner had a camera pushed in his face from the major news organization. And he was asked, gosh, this must be terrible. You lost some of your friends going into this city. It must be terrible. You must feel terrible. You must feel very depressed. He's a slow-talking kid from down south, blonde-haired kid, filthy, dirty. He just looked into the camera and said, doesn't matter. We'll hunt him down somewhere else and kill him. Completely undistressed by this. It just shows that the Marines who are disciplined, who believe in themselves, believe in their chain of command, no enemy can stop us. Even when there's a strategic mistake made, we can turn that around and go right back in and hunt them down to see for it and kill them somewhere else.
So I want to ask you, I want to follow that line about being a senior commander. At that time, you were the division commander. I want to ask you about relieving people, and because I remember hearing a saying in the Marine Corps when I was a lieutenant: no attrition, no morale. And I remember thinking, what the hell does that mean? And what I learned that it meant was that the people that are non-performers, wherever they are, they've got to go for two reasons: one, it's the right thing to do; two, other people have to see that if you don't perform, right, you're going to get the express ticket. You're going to be relieved, and you're going to go someplace else. And that is good for other people to see that. And I would tell you that, in my opinion, the good performers are always the good performers. The middle performers that fought and led under the Blue Diamond in the year that I was there in 2004, part of it working for you, the middle performers were scared shitless of you. Now, you may quarrel with that, but people would call and say, hey, is the CG headed this way? Or you'd pick up the phone to warn somebody that you were on your way. Hey, so-and-so, chaos is Oscar Mike to your position right now. And what you would get back is, holy shit, right? And so talk to us about, as a commander, should you worry about relieving somebody if they do touch the third rails? Because there's a lot of guys who really, that ties them up, and they don't relieve people that ought to be relieved. I'm curious about your thoughts on that.
Well, you have to look at whether or not you coached them properly. Did they understand clearly what was needed? Are they more senior? Obviously, I was much tougher in terms of my expectations on senior NCOs and junior, on field grade officers and company grade. I made more than my share of mistakes, but there's a big, big difference between a mistake and a lack of discipline. And once in a while, you had to recognize, you know, combat takes the veneer off us and reveals a character, close combat does. And I think that you sometimes people do not have an event in them to order troops against an enemy, knowing some of their lads are going to be killed. It's a tough thing. We don't talk much about it, but sometimes I had to remove people because they just hated to lose their people, and I respected that. Not that I knew I couldn't expect them to do something that was beyond them emotionally based on board. But by and large, if it was a lack of discipline, that's very, very easy. That didn't cause me a moment's hesitation. And we probably, in the naval service, we continue about the same levels of reliefs year in, year out. We do relieve more people than some of the other armed services. But I think that the most important thing when you look at this is determine, was this a lack of discipline or was this a mistake by someone trying to do their best? Was it a mistake by a lance corporal that you wouldn't tolerate a gunnery sergeant because you should have known better? But you just have to first of all discriminate between a mistake, an honest mistake, a young guy in his first enlistment or a lieutenant, fresh out of Quantico and the year of training he's been through by the NCOs there before he ever stands in front of a platoon. But we all make mistakes. And I've made more than my fair share. And every time I made a mistake, all the way through, it seemed like the Marine Corps promoted me and accepted those mistakes were the bridge for me learning how to do things right. Didn't mean I didn't get chewed out for it, but it was never fatal to my career. I was modestly successful in the Marines and since then. So I think you just have to be careful. If you want to build trust in a unit, can't be afraid of making mistakes. But a lack of discipline in the naval service is not a mistake. That's a choice, and that's a very bad choice for a Marine.
So I want to ask you about your personal leadership style, because on a couple occasions, as your staff sec, you orchestrated through me the discipline of officers and senior staff NCOs. And if I could describe that for people, and I won't do it in detail, but if I could describe that for people, I would tell them, as I stood against the wall and you read, you know, non-punitive letters of caution, whatever they ultimately got issued, I remember thinking to myself, thank God I'm not standing in front of that table. And because I would describe it as your fury, you know, came through loud and clear. And then when you dismiss them, in every occasion, I remember, then I would order them, you know, when I give the command that you're dismissed, you know, you will double time back to the CG and form school circle. And then you did a 180. You shook every one of their hands. You asked them about their families. And then you challenged them to be better. Talk to people about that part of that a lot of people don't see that I had the privilege to be a part of. Talk to people about that. Your personal style of not only being hard on people, but then turning around and being compassionate and then challenging them to be better.
Well, you know, if you don't love your Marines, then you really ought to get out. The only reason they're stuck around enough, they'll pay an outfit 40 years, and for the absolute pleasure of serving alongside cocky, rambunctious, disciplined, selfless, unbelievably selfless young Marine. And the infantry got its name, Infant Soldier Infantry, Young Soldier. And I enjoyed being around them. And in the military, it's all about the team. And so if you don't know the team players beyond simply their rank and last name, you don't care about deeply. I mean, just go up to Bethesda any time you want to see the cost of war and see the ranks on the rooms that you're walking into. Lance Corporal here, Lance Corporal there, CFC here, Sergeant there, Lieutenant. If you don't care about these guys, don't expect them to care about what's important to you. They're putting their lives on the line. And the fact that they joined the Marine Corps, 75% of the young 18 to 24-year-old males cannot qualify to be a private in the Marine Corps. The drill instructors put them through their paces, and we lose always some percent, 5%, 6% more. And they're in better physical shape than ever going to boot camp, going to the DI. So by the time they get out to the fleet, if they're not performing well, Generally, you'll find there's something wrong for the young guy at that home, or he was brought in on a Friday of a three-day weekend, didn't know anybody, fell in with the wrong crowd, and right away starts going to crap or something. So find what the problem is. I've not found Marines unwilling to do what needs to be done. They do like to know why they're doing it. That's what's called commander's intent in maneuver warfare, whether it be field day in the barracks or going on Libo or going across the LD against an enemy dug in the Helmand River Valley. So this is all part of making a Marine Corps where the bonds of trust are so tight that no enemy can break them. And that enemy can be drug pushers at the off-base bar. It can be any number of things that can take a Marine astray, especially in a society such as ours. And so you've got to have strong bonds, and I believe those bonds will hold everybody together in a positive way. Discipline is not about something martinet marching people in for court martial. Discipline is mostly about self-discipline. It's mostly about self-discipline. And disciplining each other, keeping each other away from guard duty when you're dead tired. Discipline at times has this onerous, you know, punishment aspect. That's not discipline, that's punishment. Sometimes, yeah. But that should be the exception if you've got coaches out there, player coaches, out there coaching the troops. And I've seen a 40-man platoon move against the enemy, and they will work a company through it the way they smoothly run against the enemy, and a Marine gets knocked down, and another Marine's on him right away until the foreman gets there while the rest of them keep moving against the enemy, and they're just smooth going against the enemy. That's a disciplined unit. It's got a lot of trust in each other, and I won't let each other down when the chips are down.
Did the you spent a lot of time as a brigadier general and also as a major general in contact with the enemy. Task Force 58, the 1st Marine Division, both of the march up, and then 2004 in Al Anbar. Did that change the way that you thought about discipline? Did it just deepen your convictions? Did you have any takeaways from all that fighting that you were a part of, that you were leading in your career? Anything change? Anything deepen?
Well, the Marine Corps has a required reading list. I remember one day I hadn't done the reading I was supposed to have done for the talk that day in the company commander's office. Of the Senate, and so he invited me to stay in my BOQ room that weekend, read the book, and have a book report on his desk the next day. the reading that the Marine Corps required of all of us in each rank, you get another set of books you're supposed to read. You know, it goes up each time you go up. They expect you to read a new book. Even generals get a new reading list. They're not considered to be just, you know, like omnipotent. You know, they suddenly can do everything. No, you got to study this. And so having studied over the years, I knew as I went up higher, having read about how undisciplined units sometimes cause problems, I needed some kind of aphorism, some kind of statement that would help convey what I thought was going to be most necessary. And that's where no better friend, no worse enemy from a dead Roman general from a couple thousand years ago. I used first do no harm. I told Marines that in order to kill a terrorist, you have to shoot across a crowded marketplace with women and children. Don't take the shot. Hunt them down another day and kill them. But first do no harm. What would you do if somebody shot and killed your son or daughter, your wife, or put one of them in a wheelchair? Don't create more problems. And I drew the veterans, of course, from the first do no harm, from the physician's oath. The surgeons, though,
right.
From antiquity. So I would adopt these from these statements that conveyed discrimination and attention and discipline. When going into Afghanistan or going into Iraq, no better friend to the people, the innocent people caught up in this, they can trust us. And for the enemy, you're going to regret it. It's going to be your longest day and worst day. But that's what we do as seniors. We try to convey our intent in reactive words, not reflective. In other words, once they've thought about it, once they're in combat, it's going to have to be reactive. And so as I went up higher, I tried to use these kinds of guiding tenets that would unleash the Marine combat capability that makes always done with understanding that every battlefield is also a humanitarian field, and it takes discipline to do the right thing. Always has in the good unit, and in the bad units, I'm both fighting them. I watched Marines on one occasion go through an undisciplined enemy unit, and it was almost sickening the way they killed them. The unit didn't know how to fight its way out of a paper bag, and the Marines were highly effective as they moved through like a killing machine. And the whole difference, I mean, they had rifles, they had machine guns, they had RPGs, we had rifles, we had 203s, we had machine guns. The difference was the discipline and the NCOs. Combat's always exciting at times. If you have good NCOs, the outcome isn't in question. So I saw what disciplined units under good NCOs should do.
Hey, sir, when the these things, the way you chunked really, really, complex concepts into those short phrases, was that part of you thinking about how do I convey these continuing actions that involve discipline? I mean, they're fairly complex. I mean, no better friend, no worse enemy. That's a pretty long paragraph were you to write it all out. Was that a conscious thing you did? Did you ever go to any advertising and classes or anything like that? Because it's called intellectually, it's called chunking information, and first do no harm, right? Short phrase, but there's this whole you know, hour long PME behind that. Did you do that consciously? Those things in order to chunk those complex concepts into small things that Marines could remember?
No, I didn't. The Marine Corps required us to read. They expected us to learn. You've got to learn this because if you don't learn it, you can't just read history. You've got to learn it. You got to live in it. But if you don't, you're going to fill body bags with Marines if you learn lessons the hard way. I knew what would happen if our Marines weren't disciplined around innocent people, we would be creating more enemies and I would lose more troops because we were actually becoming the recruiting ground for the enemy.
Right.
So no, it was just stuff I drew from my reading map, and that's why the Marine Corps expects you to read and use it. Change what you're doing. Use what you're learning and change it so your boys don't pay the price. If you could have paid with simply a couple of hours of reading one night, by learning how someone else dealt with a similar situation.
You know, one more question in your progression as a Marine officer and then ultimately up to the position of SecDef. As you went to CENTCOM, sir, and at first you went Joint Forces Command and then with NATO transition and then to CENTCOM and then ultimately as SecDef. Did your view of leadership change? Because the lens gets much broader as you're now, you know, presiding over coalition forces and NATO forces, and then as the Secretary of Defense, your lens gets much broader, and you see the Marine Corps as, you know, a stripe or a layer in this mosaic. As you've been forced through other jobs to step back, did that change your view of discipline at all?
No, Mac. I was formed by the Marine Corps, and the combat simply, at times, I can't say I fully understood some of the reasons for the Marine Corps' attention to minor things when I was a second lieutenant. But by the time I was a lieutenant colonel, I knew very well why they had put such emphasis on things that at times it seemed to frustrate me as a young officer. And now I understood how it actually did work. What we needed were discipline, but not regimented Marines. In other words, we want Marines initiative. We want two qualities in young NCOs and petty officers in the police and Marine Corps. We want initiative and we want aggressiveness. Initiative and aggressiveness. So as you move up, those are the kind of things I look for all the way through being the Secretary of Defense. What kind of leaders did I want in the Pentagon? Because I wanted to do two things right up front. One is increase the lethality of our military, and secondly, increase the number of allies we have so that we, as the old Marine saying goes, if you go into a gunfight, bring all your friends with guns. And history is pretty compelling on this, so I still tried to build trust and build respect by paying respect to other people, to other nations, to other nations' armed forces, and at the same time make sure that I had a theme to my own leadership. And I adopted George Washington, which was listen, learn, help, and then lead. So again, you listen and really listen to understand them, make sure you understand them, and that's how you're learning about them. And then you help them, find some way to help them. Doesn't have to be big, but just something that shows respect, and then you lead. So listen, learn, help, lead. And that was developed in me from my Marine Corps reading lists and from what I saw. I had wonderful leaders. NCOs, junior NCOs. I mean, when your first two platoon sergeants of your 40-man platoon are corporals, you learn just how good corporals can be if they're given the support and you listen to them. So, it's mostly just the Marine Corps. It didn't change much over those years at all.
The concept of a peer fight, sir, I mean, it's been kind of interesting as the Marine Corps pivots to the Pacific and this discussion about fighting a peer. And one of the things that I did as I do this show and do interviews I interviewed General Neill about a battle called the Battle of Gatlin's Corner. And I'm not sure, but I think it might be the most decorated fight in Marine Corps history. Lieutenant Bobo's awarded the Medal of Honor, 4 Navy Crosses, 6 Silver Stars, and 3 Bronze Stars in a 5-hour fight up near the DMZ in, I think, March of 1967. And then I interviewed one of the squad leaders. And I really got interested in the fighting in 67, 68, 69 in Leatherneck Square when the NVA would come, and they would come and try to put our heads on a stick. you know, and what it is to fight a peer. And can you undertake a fight with a peer if you're an undisciplined force?
In Korea, as you read Sternbeck's book, you see that with an undisciplined force, as unfortunately some of the American units were, not the Marines, it doesn't even take a peer to beat you if you're not disciplined. A crummy outfit, I mean, in terms of equipment and training, that well-disciplined can beat a disciplined unit that's got better equipment and that sort of thing. So, no, you can't fight a peer with an undisciplined unit. You'll lose, number one. You'll lose more people than you need to. Discipline is what separates the winners from the losers, is the bottom line. So it's simply, you know, once in a while you have people who get frustrated, and certainly our society is built on a lot of freedom, individual freedom. But on the battlefield, no matter how many Rambo movies you've watched, it's all about the team, and a team that's not disciplined cannot get the best out of the troop. Just can't do it.
Sir, have you followed this discussion that's going on? It was interesting. I was talking to Chris Woodbridge, the editor and publisher of the Gazette, and he said, you know, General Furness has lit off this pretty interesting, you know, discussion, and it's been widely debated in on different websites, and he said, I've got a tremendous amount of input from Marines of all ranks about their thoughts on discipline. Since it started, have you paid attention to it? Do you have any general thoughts on the debate as it goes on in the Marine Corps today?
No, I haven't followed it closely. Not here back in my hometown on the Columbia River. But I would say that if a force isn't focused on combat in peacetime, if a force that's designed to fight would be ready to fight first, ready when the nation is least ready, if it's not focused on war fighting, then it's going to pay a price. Like, none of us saw 9/11 coming, but the Marines were ready, and I sent them straight into a fight in Afghanistan when I was put in charge of a few mutes. So if anyone has read history, they'll know that there is no room for undisciplined units. I was reading about why in modern war, why a country thought they could beat another country, and they observed that the troops no longer saluted their officers. There were often fist fights over drinking in the forces along the demarcation line opposite them, and that their weapons appeared at times to be filthy. And based on that, a strategic decision was made to initiate a fight that cost a hell of a lot of troops' lives of that undisciplined unit before air support and other more disciplined units brought in, maneuver units were brought in to restore the situation. But it was interesting because the nation that started the fight knew they weren't as good as the other nation until they saw these signs of lack of discipline. Frankly, I'd love to fight an undisciplined enemy unit because they're so easy to kill. You don't lose as many of your own men when you do it. But the idea that there would even be a debate or a discussion about discipline. Now, let me just caveat this by saying it's not bad to have the discussion so long as it's guided by wise senior NCOs and officers explaining the reasons why we do things the way we do them. Why you have to get little things darn near perfect if you want to get the big things even half-assed right. So there's a reason for it, and that does have to be explained, and that's the healthy part of the discussion. But if someone thinks they're suddenly in a brave new world where it's warfare, discipline is less valuable, then that person is simply digging the graves for a lot of Marines. And that's just silly. There is a difference between discipline and punishment. And sometimes that is not made clear. Discipline is self-discipline, doing the right thing whether someone's around or not, running the ethical midfield. So if you make a mistake, you're not out of bounds. If you're running the ethical sidelines all the time, if you're seeing what you can get away with, then you make the mistake, you're out of bounds, and now you're going to pay the price. So you've got to run the ethical midfield. You've got to have coaches down there. I could command 1st Marine Division when we were together, Matt, in 10 minutes a day. Sign an order, make a decision about something. I spent the other 23 hours and 50 minutes a day when I was sleeping about coaching. And I was oftentimes coaching the need for standards and why we don't get sloppy. And we had something painted on the exit sign or at the exits of all the thoughts. And it said, complacency kills. And complacency is where discipline starts breaking down. And that's me to have a discussion about that. The Marine Corps is supposed to be the varsity. That's the kind of thing you do when you're in sixth grade. It's discuss whether or not you need discipline in the unit, not in the varsity.
So you've been very gracious with your time today, and I want to thank you. I have three more questions for you, and they're easy ones. Well, the first one's a general. This is the general question. What about discipline? Have I not been smart enough to ask you that you want to make Marines, other military leaders, civilians that'll listen to this? What haven't I been smart enough to ask you about discipline that you want people to make sure they know?
Well, I think you've covered it well with the question, Nash, and hopefully my answers have been somewhat helpful in understanding this. But the most important thing is to emphasize that discipline is also about using your own potential fully and not saying, well, I'm not going to go out and work out today because that's all I can do, my 3 miles in 20 minutes. I mean, until you're down to 18 minutes, I mean, you should be out there every day working on your wind sprints and everything. Discipline starts with body. You discipline your mind by studying the Marine Corps reading list, by staying current on tactics, reading the Marine Corps Gazette, reading the Leatherneck. And then spiritually is just as important. The spiritual side, emotional side, whatever you want to call it, wherever you get your spiritual strength, that should be something you share with each other. And if you do this, the need for external discipline goes down because you're disciplining yourself. And the difference between a man and a boy is a boy often needs to be disciplined. A man is setting his own standards, and his standards are higher than those of his community or his Marine Corps or of his colleague, wherever he's at. He's not interested in someone else's standards. He's going to set his high enough that he's an example, and he doesn't have to look over his shoulder to see if someone's coming after him. So I just leave it there.
All right. I'm sure everybody's curious. What are you doing these days?
Well, I'm spending time at Stanford University, and I'm talking to young people in various locations about how to come together as Americans and make sure that where we may agree or disagree on something having to do with politics, we still show respect for each other and we listen to each other, recognizing that there is truth in everybody and we can disagree on some things. But let's remember pluribus unum that's on all of our coins, out of many one, that we're all Americans. And let's keep the faith with each other in these times.
All right. And then finally, I know you're I saw a press release that said your book was going to come out here in the middle of July, but we were talking earlier and that's been pushed to the right into September.
Yeah, it'll come out the 3rd of September, Matt. It was I gained a lot from my reading, so I thought I'd put some of the lessons I've learned into my own book and put it out there and see if the junior NCOs and junior officers can learn from mistakes I made along the way, and the same way that I've benefited reading from other people's experiences. I hope this is of some value for our young Marines.
Well, I'm sure it will be. The title is Call Sign Chaos, Learning to Lead. And with a writer that everybody who reads Marine stuff will know, with Bing West. So looking forward to it. It comes out in hardback, ebook, and audiobook format here in September. So certainly I look forward to reading it, sir. Maybe you can come back on and talk about it after it comes out.
Well, thanks, Mac, for having me on. And all you young Marines out there, you keep safe and semper fi.
That is General James Mattis, United States Marine Corps retired, on another installment, the third installment of a series that we call On Discipline here on All Marine Radio. Don't touch that dial. More of All Marine Radio coming up next, right here on your home for it, the All Warrior Radio Network.